Assuming that atoms could exist without electron shells, a being that was built of them would move as freely through stones as a human through thin air. It would probably feel more at home in the Earth's deepest core than on its surface. Such beings would experience geological digestion processes, such as crystallization or the formation of minerals and ores, the way humans, animals, and plants experience the wind and the rain, or the light and the changing of the seasons. Their attention would not be directed outward, not toward the cosmos and the stars, but toward the core of our own planet. The world on the surface would seem to them like a ghostly appearance, and life as mere fleeting shadows, another density, another perception of time. On the other hand, it must be said that ordinary atoms, just by dint of those electron shells, are for the most part constructed of empty space. And if human perception were not so subject to multiple sensory conventions, the world would likely appear much more transparent. Stay focused on the stone. Look at it, protractedly and from every possible side. Initially, one chooses the stone for its attractive appearance, but it suffices to look at it long enough that it becomes interesting. To start with, around 200 BC, Chinese connoisseurs and other erudite persons in regard to aesthetics began to decorate their gardens with large stones. Stones as they were encountered in nature, rough. The stones were initially chosen based on their coincidental resemblance to famous mountains and mountain ranges, or mythical places like the Isle of the Immortals. Over the years, however, the qualifications became more abstract, and the stones were increasingly being appreciated simply for their dramatic form, their wonderful colours, or the feelings they brought about in their viewers. This was the beginning of the Gongxi culture, literally, the spiritual stone. Stones of every size were collected and admired for their surfaces, which suggested great antiquity, for their robust profiles that evoked the grandeur of nature, for their hollows, worn for centuries by water, and perforations that made rhythms and harmonic patterns visible. The Gongxi scholars developed their own topographical nomenclature. A stone had to meet certain conditions in order to be accepted as Gongxi, and the minimum requirement was that the stone had to be aesthetically interesting from at least five different standpoints. The Gongxi study refined itself through the centuries and became a highly valued art. Then there was a meteorite, which fell from the sky in 861 AD and ended up in Niigata, Japan. It should definitely have tempted some travelling Gongxi scholars to shift the subject of their observation. The gaze remained focused on the terrestrial stone, but this was now a model for a more fundamental meditation on nature in its widest scope, and what initially was dismissed as an apocryphal theory by the establishment steadily evolved into an obscure but orthodox doctrine. Although the classic study of the Gongxi already led students to the presumption that the landscape and nature in general has no need whatsoever for life in order to arrive at all the complex forms of symmetry and elegance that man usually designates as beautiful or aesthetic, this apocryphal doctrine went further by considering as a spearhead of its study just this ontological position of life in regard to nature. One needs only to think of mountain ranges, minerals and crystals, or caves filled with stalactites in order to realize that for all this dazzling splendor, not the least amount of vegetation is needed. Stone dead, nature and the world are no less elegant, so stated the new teaching. This was only the beginning of what through the coming centuries developed into holistic thinking. At the end of the 19th century, the Gongxi made a popular entry into the West and became better known as scholar stones, and around the mid-20th century, the meditative made a definite place for the decorative. In the meantime, the radical undercurrent of the Gongxi study remained focused on the stone, held the universe in its mind, and digested the thought that, however one twisted or turned it, life was not the essence of the universe. Life was overrated. Not without value, certainly not, but by no means the essence of the universe. For every grain of sand on earth, there are more than 100 stars in the cosmos. Fire will always be burning somewhere. Above our heads, under our feet, without cooked vegetables and roasted meat, the human brain could never have obtained its current mass. This drastic minimalization of life need not be confused with melancholy or a romantic obsession with death, and nor is it about a form of nihilism. The Gongxi radicals considered their findings an emancipatory consequence, and their observations generally brought them into a pleasant form of ecstasy, comparable with the way in which trance and the so-called emptying of self reduces life to a technical something, a stowage. A detachment from time is the basic requirement for any true form of space exploration. In the case of the stone, it is more correct to speak of digestion of time rather than perception of time. 10 millimeters per 2 millennia is the average growth of a stalactite. In contrast, a human grows fastest during the first 2 years of life and at the end never attains more than 2 meters. The chance encounter of a human who bumps his head into a stalactite and the effects thereof are similar to the meeting between humankind and extraterrestrial life so much desired by scientists. Sometimes occasions just miss one another. Painting has, for example, grandiosely missed the dinosaur as a theme and let the rug be pulled out from under itself by computer-generated imagery. Keep watching the stone. For the Gongxi philosophers, observation became the key. If observing lay in the extent of absorption, then the first algae, through photosynthesis and oxygen as waste product thereof, were already set up for the observing of the universe. The conclusion of Gongxi fundamentalism was the notion that they lived in a possible universe that has evolved such that from the outset it was technically determined for the development and maintenance of the observation of the universe itself. In other words, a universe with predetermined feedback. Life on Earth was one of those feedbacks. Possibly there were or were to come other feedbacks in the universe. Life on Earth is the carbon-based variant, but on a geologically deep time scale, carbon chauvinism quickly goes out of fashion. Science and space exploration and all popular culture that emerges therefrom stare themselves blind with the question of whether there is other life in the universe, a quest that stands in the way of a fundamental understanding of the universe. What do astronauts and scientists hope to find once they have reached the obscure heart of the cosmos? A sort of cosmic version of Colonel Kurtz from Conrad's Heart of Darkness, an obscene exaggeration of themselves. The Gongxi pupils gather together and observe a stone, one among the many billions, and yet there is always the question of a genuine choice, this stone and no other, and often the decision is correct, though no one can exactly reason why. Classic nomenclature is hardly ever applied. Moreover, it is no longer about beautiful or attractive stones. A good and strong stone is automatically appreciated as aesthetic in the long term.